All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
Hey, this is Unpaid Bill. This week's QLS Classic features journalist, author, and host of NBC's All In with Chris Hayes. We discuss politics, we discuss hip-hop, we discuss the Upper East Side. Originally released on July 4th, 2018. Enjoy.
We'll hold your hand through the process. It's good.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good.
Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
Chris Hayes is here.
Yeah.
To explain the fear.
Yeah.
Of why I panic.
Yeah.
When I hear in the rear view mirror.
Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
The world's a mess.
Yeah.
These are the days.
Yeah.
To be all in.
Yeah.
With the Sugar Network.
Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
Ivanka Trump.
Yeah.
Opens embassy.
Yeah.
Film at 8 p.m.
Yeah.
On MSNBC.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema. Roll call. Suprema. Suprema. Roll call.
I'm Unpaid Bill.
Yeah.
And here's my shtick.
Yeah.
You know it's time.
Yeah.
For politics.
Roll call. Suprema. Okay. Suprema. Roll call.
Okay, okay.
Suprema.
I'm waiting for this.
Suprema. Roll call.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
Since I had to rhyme.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here.
Yeah.
Just watching the time.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema. Roll call. Suprema. Suprema. Roll call. Suprema. Suprema. Roll call. Suprema. Suprema. Roll call.
Now, see, it wasn't that bad, was
not,
it?
Not too bad. Not too bad.
Okay, listen.
Questlove Supreme brought to you by the Sugar something? Network.
Yeah. Wait, can I ask a technical question about our theme?
Yeah.
Okay, do you not hear any time it's the third person's turn to rhyme? Normally it's you when Fonte's here. Do you not hear the sound of parking? Boop, boop, boop.
That's just on the track?
Literally.
Really?
Literally.
That's
every
like
time
some
I hear
shit in the background noise.
All right. Well, the next time we do the theme song, I guess when we recorded the theme.
Yeah, well, the recording's fucked up.
Do you remember the engineer's recording? Fault? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And in between, if nobody's rhyming, you can hear your guide in the background.
What's the guide?
Leaking through.
Like, right, but at what point was I in a car reverse driving to hear?
Yeah, no, that part's in your head.
Yeah, it is not.
Or it's a harmonic of something that's happening in
it's
the background.
It's not in my head. Maestro, can we run the theme one more time? We're doing it all. Yeah. Hello. I always hear it, and I'm like looking at you guys like, do you not hear it? Do you not hear it?
So wait, we have to do this all over again?
Play the theme again. We're doing, yes, this is the first time. We're doing all new theme.
No, it, listen to it without us singing that.
Yeah, just listen to it.
Okay. Nothing there. Suprema. I can't believe I'm doing this on my own show.
Yes. Okay,
Suprema. Oh, God, this is where the chorus comes in. Yada, yada. Okay. Okay, so then this is when Amir speaks.
Yeah.
And then I say something else.
Yeah.
And then here comes the setup.
Okay.
And then the punchline.
Ha ha ha.
Suprema.
Shout out to Mark Kelly and Ray Angry. They sound great on this.
Right. Well, the drums just drum themselves.
Oh, and the drummer. You.
Second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can hear him.
I hear somebody
talking. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I hear somebody talking.
All right. Now wait. Here comes the third one. You ready? Here we go. Someone's parking a car.
Oh, I hear it. Yep. Yeah.
It's a
feedback harmonic.
Feedback.
No, somebody out.
No, that sounds like someone.
All right, now we can lower it.
Sounds or like it's that, someone backing up a goddamn delivery truck.
Yeah, that's what it sounds
like. Whatever.
All right, you can lower the volume. Yeah, I'm just saying that someone was backing that thing up.
Okay.
QLS Look, taking over for the 99.
I don't let the small shit slide. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very deep political episode.
Already.
Oh, yeah.
Already.
Thanks for pointing out the horrible engineering.
Politics
on
of delivery trucks and shitty
engineering. I thought it was me. I don't know. I was like, did I make the theme in the car? I don't know. It just happens every time.
Hey, look, we have a guest.
Oh, damn. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another Questlove Supreme. We got Sugar Steve of the Sugar Network explaining to our guests how powerful his network is.
Well, the long story short of what we're talking about is this new feature that Instagram has, which, yes, allows you to interview somebody on your live story where you're on the top and they're on the bottom.
But we have a guest. we have double bill. We're double billed today,
Woo!
Unpaid and boss bill. And our guest today, ladies and gentlemen, he is a journalist. Some say that he's the co-leader of the liberal media along with with Rachel Maddow. Bronx native, Hunter College, which is actually a high school.
Hunter College High School, yeah.
Yeah, which is weird.
Stupid.
Yeah. Oh, no.
I mean, just the name. It's a wonderful high school. I used to live right near it. It's great.
But. Host of one of my favorite MSNBC shows, and of course, after this election cycle, my station channel always stays on MSNBC. All In with Chris Hayes, and probably author of the best liberal splain book of our imbalanced system. I have to say, well written.
Thanks, I
feel like it's almost, to date myself, a Cliff Notes. A Cliff Notes to people who are like sort of on the fence.
Exactly. Yeah.
Of, you know, like those people that ask, like, well, they must have did something, and this is the best liberal splain book. I actually, when I got it, and I got it like 3 days ago, I didn't think I was going to get through it in time for the our interview today. But it's an
That's
easy
great.
Read. I got
yeah,
through
that,
it.
That was sort of by design that people would. My favorite thing that people say, my two favorite bits of feedback from the book, one is that people are like, oh, I sat down, I read it in one sitting, or I got through it really mm-hmm. quick. And two is for people that are, you know, I don't think, the audience for the book, I don't think, is people that are hardcore, like, you know, Blue Lives Matter and Black Lives Matter.
Right.
Or, you know, and I'm not going to I'm going to boycott the NFL because Colin Kaepernick is kneeling. Yeah, yeah. Like, I it's going to be hard to reach those folks. But there's a huge swath of people, particularly white folks, that I think are generally sympathetic, but also, like, that kind of, mm-hmm. they must have done, they did something, right?
Right.
There was a reason. Like, there, yeah, was it, did he really? And the book is an attempt to try to walk people through kind of some of the realities of what it actually looks like.
It's well executed. Anyway, I haven't said his name.
No, what's the name of the book?
Well, I haven't said the author's name yet either. Let's see how long we're going. Yeah. Can I get to 10 minutes without
tease,
even saying
it?
Let's not try to.
Steve, finish your Instagram.
So one night I was on Instagram and I was like, I'm going to play.
Wait, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the author
the
of
again?
Colony and a Nation and our friend Chris Hayes to Questlove Supreme.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, before we get on to that, yes, Steve.
No, you really don't have to go back.
Well, we had a guest.
That's your relationship.
It's taking me 10 minutes to explain who he is.
So the feature just came out recently, a few months ago, and I was just messing around with it one night, and I was super high, and I was like, I'm going to be Chris Hayes, and I'm going to interview a motherfucker. So I started, how does
that invite request show up on someone's account? Like,
you two have to mutually follow each other,
right? So if you're following
each other, please make that happen. Yeah. By the way,
you can either invite them or they can invite you. It's obvious something pops up, and you both have to be cool with it.
Right.
You can't just
show up
on somebody's screen.
Well, you can do that too.
There's no way.
Maybe you have to be verified. I have special powers.
Shut the shit down.
Wow. Maybe I have special powers.
Yes, verified people can just hack your phone. Yes.
Well, you've got the blue check mark.
There's a list of people that I'm following that are following me that I can talk to.
Right? Illuminati.
And then if I want to interview Erica, I can also search for her name. I have an option that lets me search for her name. Press her, and if she accepts,
yeah, and then you go live, and it anyone
and
who,
people watch. It's a voyeurist game. People watch each other interview each other. So Steve is taking us actually to the next level.
Like, yeah, I got to a few hundred people going, you know, in the network. And
do you
like,
find it unnerving to watch in real time how many people are watching?
Meaning what? How few people are watching?
No, I find something bizarre. Like when we'll do a Facebook Live before the show, mm-hmm. and my whole life in a weird way gets, you know, we get the ratings every day at 4:15, and at MSNBC we get a spreadsheet, and it matters a lot. Like what kind of numbers you're doing, it resonates throughout the building, you know. So in a weird way, a lot of my professional life is oriented towards this number. Mm-hmm. And I find something unnerving about the instant feedback as you're talking of like seeing the number go up and down. Like it's some kind of
dystopic,
like you say the wrong thing, and it goes,
absolute extremist version of mm-hmm. let me perform in the way what will maximally get people to.
And you hate it when it trickles down.
Exactly. Like, oh, what am I doing? What am I doing?
Say
go
something
back,
smart. Say something
back,
smart.
Go back.
It's most people will probably sit for a good 8-9 seconds.
Right.
And I noticed that. I mean, one time I had a very magical moment happen on my feed where it was like at an actual D'Angelo rehearsal.
I did one of those too.
With comments. No, I'm just saying that. It was like even at a D'Angelo rehearsal for the Roots Picnic, like, you know, if my numbers went to ungodly, like four figures. And then about 15 minutes later, it went down to like 300. Which, you know, maybe it is kind of ridiculous to, but the thing is that your people.
I was at that rehearsal. It got kind of boring as it went on.
Yeah. Wait, it was?
Uh-huh.
Oh. Just see, my like, shows don't, that hit, doesn't happen.
It just drifts. Like, it was like, it was all hitting and then everybody sort of just went for a walk and it kind of went away. And then.
Yeah, but I mean, I think just the art of, or the task of watching someone have a conversation.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, one of the things that I learned, one of the kind of crash course realities of this job is keeping people's attention is hard. It's work to keep people's attention. You know.
So okay, as a fan of the show on HBO? I'm gonna take the long scenic route. Star Dumb and Dumber, not Jim Carrey, the other one.
Jeff Bridges.
His show on HBO about
Jeff Daniels.
Newsroom? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, Newsroom. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So when you're on the air, do you have an earpiece in which there's a producer like, okay, now ask about this. And then.
So you're always passionate to the control room through what's called an IFB, right? So you got an earpiece. Mm-hmm. And there's a really wide spectrum of how active the control room is in that in questions. In my case, almost never, I would say a few times a week, the control room will suggest a question, but it's very rare, partly because I get super annoyed.
Okay. It's like, well, it throws you off your rhythm, right?
It just feels like backseat driving. It's like, I'm at the wheel, so don't tell me to make a left here. I know what I'm doing. That other people have different feelings about that. That's my feeling about it.
Does that depend on the relationship you have with your producer?
I think it does. It depends on, you know, different shows have a different balance between how host-driven and how producer-driven they are. Different hosts have different levels of comfort of asking questions in the moment. Like, some want questions pre-written in prompter to go through that they've already done through like a process. Some don't want anything in prompter. They just want to kind of think in the moment, which is usually the way I am. Like, I kind of know what I want to ask, but I want to be... One of the things I think that happens is if you script it too much...
Kind of like this show.
You don't listen, right? Because one of the things that can happen is if you've got your idea about question one is this and question two, and you ask question one, what you're doing in your head is, okay, now I'm on question two, as opposed to, wait, what are they saying?
Engaging.
But I think it varies a lot. The person I talk to the most, is the line producer on the show, who's the person who keeps time, which is a key part of the whole.
Right.
You know, she's the drummer.
Right.
She's the drummer for the show. So we got to figure out, you know, we got to bring things in at certain moments, and we got to hit our marks to make a show because it's live.
Right.
It's a zero sum. You go long here. You got to go short here. You got to cut something here. And she's the one with cues. A minute. Got to get to break. Okay, we're over.
So I'm not certain if All In is the type of show that deals with real time, this just in, but certainly or surely with the time that we're living in, especially with you know who behind the wheel, that can happen. Even this morning, like, you know, Hallie Jackson had an entirely different show plan,
and then she got 4,000 pages probably of transcripts,
and then she got a this just in,
yeah.
And then how much on your game? Well, I know you have to be on your game, but how annoying is it that at any moment the world can fall apart, and you have to be fluid and explain and knowledgeable, and
it's both. I would say it's invigorating and thrilling in its own way, because there's a certain adrenaline to it when something happens at 7:15 and it's like, okay, we're making decisions. Okay, this is the new A block. Then what gets kicked out? Then A goes down to B, then B gets killed, or do we keep the guest there and then we move to C, or do we move to G? Like, and you're making all these decisions very quickly. One of the blessings, and I imagine it's actually this way on The Tonight Show, that there's a bizarre blessing of having a live show at 8 o'clock, in that we don't have an option not to do it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if news breaks at 7:15, whatever happens in those 45 minutes, the show comes on air at 8. Yeah. And there's something weirdly relieving of stress about that, because if it was like, no, it has to be perfect, let's wait till 8:25 to make sure that it's perfect. Is that Manny Patinkin? Hey, Manny Patinkin. Hey, how are
just
you?
Just so...
Wow, that is the most wild thing that's ever happened to me in my life.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
We just got up the ante. Manny Patinkin's here,
Manny
ladies and
gentlemen. Manny just randomly walks in a room.
Star of Homeland.
Yeah. Yeah, come on in.
You want to be a part of it?
Just...
My wife's a big fan.
Oh. Well, we're...
Hey, guys.
Yes. No,
no,
you're on
no,
a
no.
podcast.
Hey,
this is Chris
Hayes,
and
hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
How are you? Good, good.
This is fucking
good
awesome.
Hi, how are you?
Man, it's good to see you again.
I came in, I saw all the furniture, I thought, where's the bed? I didn't put it in. We're working down the hall.
Cool. Yeah.
Awesome.
Very cool. Enjoy.
Very nice
to
meet you.
What are you podcasting?
I have a podcast, and Chris Hayes from MSNBC is the host of it. Yeah.
He's the host.
Oh,
well, the guest. You're the host.
He's the guest.
I don't know who I am right now. Yeah.
Okay, great. All right.
Thank you.
That's his book.
Oh, it's a copy of my book. Yeah.
Can I have
one? Absolutely. Oh, that would be my great pleasure.
Okay, guys, have fun.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Mandy.
You're a legend. You're a legend. Wow. Literally.
That was the fucking best thing that ever just happened.
Thank you for being on Chatting with Sugar.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte, Fontigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? Well, no, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Can I tell a Mandy Patinkin story when you're
on Instagram?
Can we interrupt your informative?
No, of course, yes.
Wait, hit me.
I was working on a musical, and Mandy Patinkin was going to be in it, and he came and sang and delivered and told all these stories about his mother, and he's a very fascinating human being. I could talk about him for a long time, but that was an awesome cameo in Questlove Supreme, only on Pandora Sugar Network. Fucking Mandy Patinkin. That was amazing.
Do we got to get him to sign some shit?
We'll just cut it out. No! We can't.
No, he has to remain.
I mean, we didn't get D'Angelo to sign for his
three. Yeah, just...
D'Angelo didn't say shit, though.
Yes, he did.
Did he?
Yeah,
it's he said more R&B. Words.
It's more R&B. And then he walked out.
Wait, what was the question to?
I can't remember.
It was a Prince something.
Probably.
It was more R&B.
And then he went to get cigarettes and never came back.
Like that. All right, so...
Man, he's so... What's the right word? Like, he is so entirely himself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you would expect that, but that was what I would expect Mandy Patinkin to be like.
Yeah.
That was pretty awesome.
Wow. That was great. You're the host of the show now, so what else?
You told me I'm the host.
What else do you want to ask me?
Basically, we kind of just got an example of when something crazy happens in the middle of a show, and then you just
And I lose control.
Yes, you were just talking about how you react to in-the-moment improvisation.
Exactly. I could never be on him.
Plan that.
And you got all flustered. You were like, he's the host of my show. Wait, I'm Chris Hayes. That's Quest.
What was your very first journalist assignment? Like, what is the road that leads to you having your own show? And is there an internship that leads, like, did you work at a newsroom? And
I came up a sort of a weird way, and in a way that doesn't really exist anymore, partly because the ecosystem I came through has all died off a little bit. I graduated from college and was really into theater and moved to Chicago with my then girlfriend, now wife, and Chicago's super cheap. I don't know if any of you have ever lived in Chicago, but it is a great place if you're 22 and broke, because it's so much cheaper than New York. It's so much cheaper than LA. The winter sucks, but there's a lot of people in Chicago doing a lot of really cool stuff because people pay nothing for rent. And there's like people playing shows in the abandoned buildings and doing theater and photography. And I was there doing theater and also freelance writing and started.
Sorry. What'd you major in there?
I majored in philosophy.
Okay.
Yeah, I majored in philosophy. I was doing theater, and I started writing for the Chicago Reader, which is like the alternative weekly there. It's like the Village Voice, Washington, D.C. city paper like that. And I started freelancing and had more and more success doing that, started writing for more publications, like online liberal publications. I got a job at a lefty magazine called In These Times. I then got hired by The Nation. And then my wife got a job in Washington, D.C., clerking on the Supreme Court. In 2007, we moved to Washington, D.C. She was clerking for Justice Stevens, which was an amazing thing to see up close. And I became through complete accident, the longtime Washington bureau chief of The Nation magazine, David Korn, left to go to Mother Jones 3 months after I moved to D.C. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, we need a new bureau chief. And they interviewed me and they gave me the job. And from that, I started appearing on television as a talking head pundit. I'm the Washington bureau chief of The Nation. So what do you think about, and this was in the sort of last year, the Bush administration and the 2008 campaign and the financial crisis and all that.
But how often does that happen? Usually, don't you have to like work your way up the ranks at a paper? And so,
yeah, it was a bunch of accidents.
So timing was perfect.
Timing. Okay. And I think the fact that I had a background in theater, I'd acted, I had a little bit of a performance background. I like to talk. Mm-hmm. I think that was, you know, we try people out on TV all the time, and talking on TV is a very specific and weird skill that is different than talking. It's different than being an interesting person. It's just a weird skill. You sit in a room, you stare into a camera, it you don't have any of the physical cues that come. Like right now we're all looking at each other, like you're nodding your head when I say something, which is a nice encouragement. I keep going. But you don't have that in a TV studio. It's a weird and alienating experience.
Oh, you're saying even that's more different than this, than what we're doing right now?
Oh, yeah.
Because I feel definitely. Like this exposes everything about me, whereas I'm better tweeting and typing thoughts
than this.
Than I am, because I have to think about things and right. Yeah, and edit, where I'm even 2 years into this, I feel like I'm not fluid at all. And
well, that I would disagree with that, but I would say that it's really interesting.
Ask Bill.
People have different experiences of how they, you know, how they talk and how easily that kind of that form of communication comes to them. And I think I had a sort of aptitude for it. And so what happened was I started getting booked more and more as a guest. Eventually in 2010, I was asked to guest host a show for Rachel. That was a huge deal. I went down to New York a day early. I read off the teleprompter as practice. I was nervous AF. Mm-hmm. I was so nervous. Right. And then I did it and it went well. And it rated well. And then I started guest hosting more and more often. And the more I guest hosted, then I moved from that to a weekend show and from the weekend show to an evening show. So it was a very strange route, because I came through kind of liberal, lefty magazine, alternative weekly journalism on the print side. I was a writer, always a writer. I didn't have any TV background. I didn't intern at a local station. I wasn't a news anchor at a, you know, station in Des Moines, or, you know, people move from smaller markets to bigger markets. I came in this completely different direction and kind of had to learn TV as I went.
Wow. So,
Chris.
Like you.
Yeah.
You had to learn TV as you went. So did I. As I went.
Hey, Chris. So what percentage of your current job is journalism? What percentage is performance, let's say?
It's a great, great question.
I only ask great questions. You should tune in tonight.
Imagine your Instagram channel is amazing. The 8-hour extended Mandy Patinkin interview.
Holy shit.
The ring cycle of Instagram interviews. I basically am consuming things all day, and I'm trying to report every day, which means that I'm constantly in contact with a bunch of different people in different areas. But, you know, the staff is, you know, we've got 25 people to make an hour of TV, and so much of it is taken up with just getting that thing on the air. I would love it if we had a newsroom where we were sending people out, you know, we had dozens of reporters to do enterprise journalism every day. In terms of what I'm doing, I think it's a combination. I mean, you kind of can't separate the performance part from it, because if the performance part isn't there, then people are not going to watch. But the interviews, you know, my favorite, we had someone on last night. We had a political reporter wrote a great piece about basically the Trump administration burying a report that came from their own administration about the toxicity levels of certain chemicals in water. Mm-hmm. And they were like, let's not release this. It'll freak everyone out. And my favorite moments that happen on TV are when I'm learning something live in the moment from the interview, because that feels like I'm making discovery. So we talked to this reporter. She was great. I learned from her. I learned things I hadn't learned even in reading her piece. And I try to get as many of those moments as I can in the show, where as opposed to some pre-rehearsed thing where I throw a lob and you dunk it, that I'm actually like, we're actually reacting to each other and I'm learning things in real time.
So, all right, similar to the comedy world where, save news of the week. All right. So say as of this cycle or this us speaking right now, Kanye opinions are like a thing right now in the comedy world where, right?
Yeah.
Kanye's so crazy.
Right.
Or it, even
right. just, Kanye takes.
Let's go, years ago where it was always OJ jokes, that yep. sort of thing. With the way that your particular channel runs, if everyone is telling the same story, mm-hmm. is that just with the thought in mind that there's no one watching this show concurrently, like 9 hours in a row, and that you just have to refresh and retell the story again, and I'll take Stephanie Ruhle's take on it, and right. Hallie and so, but what is there...
Is there
cool? I mean, I don't want to say a competition thing.
No,
but
no.
Like, are you guys dreaming of like, okay, this is going to be my Bob Woodward
totally.
Moment or you know, my Carl Bernstein.
I would say that.
Who's going to play me in the movie when I bust this story open?
Well, it's a balance between the two. So there's two competing impulses. I think one is you don't want to run the same show over and over, and repetition's a real problem. And it's a real challenge. And there's, I think partly, we can't think of it as, okay, someone's watching the network for 4 hours, because it's a little like 10-10 wins here in New York City, mm-hmm. right? Like traffic and weather together every 12 minutes because people are just cycling through. Right. And so it's like, well, I already know the traffic and weather. It's like, well, you other people are coming to it. We got to tell them what's up. So there's a little bit of that, right? So a certain amount of repetition. At the same time, you do want to distinguish the shows. And the real hard part is, and I say this about TV all the time, which is that plants grow towards the light. And what I mean by that is you can have a garden in your backyard and you can plant everything all nice and spaced out. And if you come back 6 months later and light is only hitting one part, all of the plants have grown over here. And the light is ratings, attention, what people are paying attention to. And so what will inevitably happen is people chase the stories that they feel like there's the most juice in, that there's the most attention in. And that leads to a certain inescapable level of redundancy about what the stories of the day are. Not always defensible. I think sometimes that there's certain myths get embedded in people's heads about what people are interested in. There's a little bit of a bubble that can happen, which is that you work in this building where the TV's on all day. So you're constantly looking up at cable news and you're like, oh, they're talking about X. X is the thing we should talk about. So I actually try to keep the TVs off in my office for that reason.
Okay.
Precisely because I don't want to
be... So you're not influenced?
I just don't want to be overly influenced by what everyone in cable news is talking about all the time, because then you can have a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy about that. But it's a challenge. We have a bunch of meetings throughout the day in which the production staffs of the different shows actually huddle and talk about what their respective rundowns are and try to make sure that we're not all doing the same show.
Okay, so without being too biased towards whatever my cable news preference is.
Right.
I think there was, I was in a waiting room in an airport once, and that's probably the longest I've been in a place in which Fox News was constantly running. Well, they did some weird thing where Fox News was on this television, but then behind me was CNN in the same room playing at the same time.
That must have been a lot.
Yeah, it was like
unpleasant.
One of them large like waiting room things. And so then it finally hit me why Fox News' ratings is how it is. One, I didn't know that they exploited women that much to that level. It's like practically every journalist, even if it's with a male journalist, there's always a leggy,
yes.
thigh-y, stiletto-heeled
yep.
young blonde journalist. And I was like, oh... This is why everyone's watching Fox. Like, I finally got it. Because in my head, I'm like, people can't. I know people want to accept the reality that they accept. I mean, I feel as though of the three, the big three networks, that you guys tell the truth of what's happening, regardless of what it is. But is there, because there was a point where a lot of my favorite shows were getting pushed to the side. Like suddenly Ronan didn't have his show in the afternoon, and the
went Circle, off Daily Show, and
Joe and the Torres thing, right, and like a whole bunch of MSNBC. And I was fearing that, oh God, they're trying to, they're feeling the pressure of Fox News. Like, will they adjust? Or I didn't know if it's new management, but how do you fear that one day there will be, the hammer comes down, it's just like, okay, people aren't here for the truth anymore, and we gotta...
You know, I sort of experienced this in reverse, because when we launched the show in 2013, interest in politics was at a real low point. I mean, Barack Obama's just been reelected. Congress is in the hand of Republicans. There's this kind of stalemate, you know, and people just were like, eh, I'm kind of done with politics. I think Barack Obama's reelection particularly was like, okay, that's the end of that chapter, right? Like the,
I can go on with life.
Yeah.
Now.
Like we had George W. Bush, and then like this crazy, insane financial crisis, and also the this crazy, insane campaign. And also we elected the first black president, and then it was like, is he going to get reelected? And then he did. And it was sort of like, okay, well, we've got a sort of narrative arc here.
But that was a dangerous four years of
extremely. Yeah. But people, a lot of people checked out, and we saw it in the numbers. I mean, so my experience is I've been doing the show for 5 years, 2013. We started 2013, 14, 15. Those were lean years. And that's when a lot of those shows were getting canceled. And I think it was a combination of there was new management that came in, but also everyone was kind of struggling, trying to figure out what gets people's attention. I mean, you remember the missing plane thing, right? When the plane went missing. And that became this running joke, understandably, because it was insane how much cable news covered it. Mm-hmm. But people were covering it out of desperation because it was the only thing rating. It's like you couldn't get people to...
Did we ever find that plane?
No. It's crazy.
Okay.
Yeah. That's one of those for where did we end up on that files?
Yeah.
Like where did we end up on the plane?
Oh, that
I know it was missing, but...
And they thought they found it, but they didn't.
Right.
It's gone.
So what's happened instead over the course of our trajectory on the show is that we now have, we've got four times as many viewers as we had, you know, back in 2013, 2014, the lean years. And I feel like if the viewers are there, we're there. But TV is fickle. I mean, TV is rough. It's like the restaurant business in New York City.
Like, so you don't even feel secure in your position now as a anchor of that show?
I will say this. I feel the most secure I've ever felt. Like, I have a contract. I'm going to be there through 2020, you know, barring something completely unforeseen.
Right.
And I feel as secure as I've ever felt. But I also understand that it's a crazy business. And, you know, things blow up all the time, and things get canceled, they get moved around. It's just the nature of the business, and you got to kind of be a little at peace with that. Otherwise, you're going to stress yourself out all the time.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. connect the snooze, 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower, lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Normally, well, we kind of worked our way backwards, but I always start at your beginnings.
Can I just ask one more question before we go backwards? And speaking of like Fickle and TV and stuff, Trump fatigue. So I'm kind of a news junkie, or I was, and now I'm kind of like, I have Trump fatigue.
You've hit your point.
Yeah, I stopped.
That's interesting.
And well, it's sort of correlated with the beginning of chatting with Sugar. So I just, I don't really do anything anymore except that. But in all seriousness though, do you get that? Do you have that? Are you getting that? Do you fear having that?
I feel it sometimes. I think, you know, there are times where it feels a little like being trapped in a dysfunctional or toxic relationship or a toxic household. Like, I've been very lucky in my life that the people that are closest to me, I haven't had to deal with people very close in my life that are really toxic personalities. Mm. People have parents that are toxic personalities. They have partners that are, you know, siblings. Like, people deal with that. They deal with that all the time. I've been very lucky. My loved ones aren't like that. I feel like I have this weird experience of it now because so much of my day is dominated by the president of the United States and what he's doing. And I think I have some craving to get outside that a little bit. We actually just launched a podcast that called Why Is This Happening, where I get to have kind of longer conversations with people and outside of the specifics of the daily news cycle that tends to be so driven by the president. And partly I think that's because that's nurturing a need I have.
to talk about someone else?
Yeah, talk about other stuff. I mean, just to talk about, you know, I've been trying recently. I just find myself so trapped in the news cycle just for my job that I've been trying to like read more books and I just, you know, read novels. And
don't you think, like, I listen to all your podcasts on the way in and as far as you try to get away from them, they all circle back to Trump and what's going on now. Like the conservative one, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
As far out as you go, you always get sucked back into this thing. Like
that's a good point.
It was like the Middle East and was all about like, but then it was like Kushner, what's going on in the Middle East? Like
totally.
Every one of them.
Yeah, no. And I think as we go further, I think we want to try to push to go further afield. Sure. Part of it also is, I mean, the funny thing about that, right? This comes back to this question about, you know, the plants growing towards the light. So I was like obsessively looking at the podcast numbers last night because I'm a crazy compulsive addicted junkie.
Sounds like me.
Yeah,
you this, have is, to be this is the, well, I, this is the
no. I stopped looking at my Metacritic numbers like maybe 3 months ago. But yeah, at one point, man, like, well,
it's so toxic. Sick. That we all do toxic. It. Everyone,
I do it too. It's terrible.
Yeah, authors, man. You talk to authors, they sit there just hitting refresh on that Amazon page, look at the ranking, and it's like, it's crazy.
Don't even get me started with that shit. Yeah,
it's crazy.
Creative
but
quest.
So I was looking at it last night, and sure enough, right, we put out 3 episodes, and one is very explicitly about Trump and how he fits into conservatism, and lo and behold, that's the best performing one.
Yeah.
Right. which is not that surprising because the. Even if there are people, I think, like yourself, and I think that's not an uncommon experience, this sort of fatigue, there's also just this insatiable desire to try to understand.
But it also felt like the most relatable. Sorry to interrupt you. It felt like the most relatable, the one about conservatism, too. It was very black and white to me. It was like, this is the guy you had on was
Queer
very,
Robin, yeah.
Yeah, it was very explicit about what he, it felt very clear to me.
Yeah.
Is it hard to not insert your personal beliefs into a situation and be neutral? Because the thing is that this is the first time in which I'm seeing being neutral being a dangerous thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I would...
You're not neutral.
You
define yourself.
Well, no, I know that, but I'm just saying that is it... The days of, you know, you not knowing where Walter Cronkite...
This may take a while.
Rural juror. Walter Cronkite.
Rural
juror. Yeah, with Walter Cronkite or Peter Jennings or whatever.
Right.
Like the days of just asking a question.
Yeah, it's done.
And you know.
Yeah, I think that the model that we have and that I have is that I'm not neutral, that I have a set of beliefs and a worldview that people know and are familiar with. But we try really hard on the show to be what I would say would be fair and to be open-minded, to not take cheap shots, to not just tell ourselves things that feel good, to not be hacks, right? So that, oh, well, this Republican was accused of sexual harassment and ergo, that person's terrible, and we're going to do a hit piece segment on them. And then the next day, this Democrat was accused of sexual harassment. Like, we're just going to keep that out of the show.
Right. Okay.
Like, the other night, for instance, 40 minutes before we went to air, Eric Schneiderman, the New York Attorney General, there was a piece in The New Yorker,
right,
a devastating, horrifying piece in which he's alleged to be this just sort of psychotically disgusting abuser. I mean, with women in his
Ronan's
life.
Ronan's piece.
Yeah, Ronan's piece.
Yikes.
Ronan does, man.
People on the record, women on the record, talking about this horrible physical and verbal abuse from him. And it broke at 7:20, and I was like, "We're doing this in the show because Eric Schneiderman's been on our show, and it's important that this we don't. You know, if you were a Republican, we do it. If you're a Democrat, we do it. So there's a level at which like we have our worldview, but we also are not just out there trying to play for a team, which is really important to me. Like that we are good faith arbiters from the perspective of a set of values as opposed to a perspective of one of two tribes or one of two colors or one of two teams.
But like when you were coming up, we're fairly the same age. Like you were saying, I feel like Peter Jennings and Dan Rather, they're all like trying to be the face of neutrality and try to present both things. When did you decide to really define yourself as being liberal? Because like your Wikipedia page, it says a liberal commentary. It's like it feels like that's something you're very proud of or whatever. Or
well, it went the other way. So people that come up through TV have to be neutral, I think, as they come up. Because if you're reading the news in Des Moines or in Broward County or wherever, you got it. That's the way the business model works. And then if you work your way up past that and you're doing other stuff. For me, I started as just a writer writing for explicitly ideological publications where everybody knew. So The Nation magazine and In These Times and Chicago Reader to a certain extent, like they were places where that was just part of the social contract with the reader. Like the reader right. understood.
They knew what they were getting.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I read a lot of different stuff from different ideological corners that I really like because to me, the most important thing is just to be honest and upfront and not be deceptive, right? So the sort of sneak attack, the kind of like, oh, well, this is just when you're smuggling stuff in and you're not telling them, as opposed to you're saying like, hey, I'm a conservative and here's why I think, you know, X about the tax cuts or X about our cultural rot of Hollywood or whatever it is. That's interesting to me and I can engage with that. It's the bad faith deception that I find a little unnerving.
Well, actually, this could lead us into a colony and a nation, which I always felt that the term liberal was sort of a dog whistle term that conservative media has come up with when they describe a journalist that considers black people, gay people, brown people, anyone not under the white male hetero kind of umbrella as equals. I always felt as though that has been the sort of dog whistle term of which there's a great part of in chapter 4 where you really explain the genesis of the idea of white fear and that the fear of losing,
mm-hmm.
knowing, acknowledging that you have an advantage and that one day it could be lost. And I almost feel as that's where that falls under. So even, I mean, I consider when I hear liberal, I feel that that's the hidden four letter word that, I mean, basically is you're telling the truth.
Right.
In my opinion. But of course, like the way that we're programmed and built today, that it's kind of like, you know, you have to preface with, you know, I'm neutral and I'm that sort of thing. So I like, how do you feel when you hear that title?
I don't, you know, it's funny, liberal, I don't feel like there's really a great term that I feel like I want to embrace. Like, liberal doesn't feel quite right. Progressive doesn't feel quite right. Leftist doesn't feel, none of those feel quite right. I don't know what the right term is.
Like, what does a Fox journalist call themselves?
Oh, you know, they say they're unbiased or they're, you know, I think Sean Hannity calls them, I think, yeah, that's not true. I think Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, they would all call themselves conservatives. I think they would say that they were conservatives. I think if I were to, you know, my biggest commitment, I would, and this is a word that you, I think sounds annoying if you go around calling yourself this, but an egalitarian. I mean, I'm like, I'm really, my worldview is really ordered around equality and getting to equality and what a society with real genuine, that took equality seriously would look like and what that would mean for full human flourishing. I mean, you know, it's easy, I think, sometimes to lose sight. Everything gets so cramped of like, what is the project? Why are we as humans? Why do we build a democratic society? Why do we do any of this? What's the idea behind this all? And the idea is to facilitate human flourishing. The idea is for everybody has an opportunity and a chance and is given the tools to flourish, to do things they love, to do things they enjoy, to be in relationships that are fulfilling to them, to go on vacations and play on the beach. I mean, that's the vision here. And there's a bunch of questions about how do you get that vision. But to me, when we have hierarchies and categorical systems that put some people on one side of a line and some people on the other of it, whether that's through the way the economy works or in the case of a colony nation, policing, like that's the fundamental thing that I'm taken with, that I think about are those hierarchies and that and getting to equality and sort of ways that we can upend those hierarchies.
When you were a kid, what were your aspirations as far as what you thought you were going to do as an adult when you were 6 or 7 years old?
Well, when I was 6 or 7, I probably wanted to be a basketball player, okay. To be honest. That did not work out. I was like barely a high school varsity basketball player, so I was a long way.
Okay.
But that philosophy degree from Brown.
Yeah, yeah. Weirdly. Yeah, I knocked around the D-League for a bit, but no, I would say that the two biggest things I thought about was something in some kind of way of like, I think I always wanted to perform in some ways, and then I think I really wanted to be an intellectual, even at a really young age. Like I wanted to be a professor. You know, I want to be someone who learned for a living and wrote books for a living and, you know, engaged with other people about ideas. And that I think I wanted to do that even when I was really, really young. I think 7, 8, 9, probably I wanted to do that.
That's weird because I feel like I was just forced into that position, like
forced intellectualism.
No, I mean, just forced into the whatever the teacher role that people expect me to be. Then I was like, well. What the fuck? Okay.
But what did you cool. What did you want to be?
No, I was going to be a musician, and then
from real young,
from the age of 2. But the thing was, is that because
did you come from or your
my family? I came from a musical think the Black Partridge Family. So right. I came from that sort of environment. But now that I think about it, it's either you're going to be a musician and pursue and create art. Which I think I did.
Yeah.
But then I get equal amounts of pleasure of studying other people's method of making art.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, would I rather, you know, go batshit crazy over watching other people make art and marvel over it and figure out the process of how they did it versus me just doing it myself, right. Like my version of it. And I actually think that the former is what I gravitate towards. So,
really?
Yeah.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, What I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? Well, no, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
I always think to myself, if I could be given any power or ability in the world, I mean, the honest and lame answer is probably dunk a basketball. But if you put that you put that aside, like really dunk. I mean, like really. I don't mean like the just get me over. Yo, like
wait,
I
did you have like a moment the dude in on YouTube where, like,
who
you
trained for 10 months. Right. And, I mean, like throw it down.
Throw it down.
But I would say after that, the number one thing would be to like write a great song. That to me seems like the ultimate superpower. Like to walk through Earth. And being able to do that.
See, that's weird. I'd rather discover a great song. Like, in my mind,
it's really fascinating to me.
Really?
I know somewhere in, it's like, do I dream of like, man, I'm going to write a great song that's going to change people's lives. And hey, it's me writing Song of the Year and I'm holding my Grammy. I don't have those dreams. Hmm. My dreams are, man, I know in that Prince vault. There's at least,
let me in.
Yeah,
there's at least 41 songs. At least of those thousands, I know at least there's 41 songs that could change my life.
Got to get to them.
Like nothing
change
will
other people's lives or just change your life?
My life.
No, like, just discovery. You're saying discovery as opposed to creation.
And you know what it was? Okay, so when I'll give you an example. So maybe a month before the Purple Rain reissue came out, when, quote, my connect gave me whatever the final listing was going to be of the extra songs that were making it, he sent me a particular song. He sent me We Can Funk, or We Can Fuck. Funk. And I can't describe it to you, but in hearing it and knowing that song already and heard it and it's different incarnations of in bootlegology. At one point, for a particular minute, I was back to being that 13-year-old that there's nothing like staring at the speaker, discovering new music and how it made you. It just brought me back to 5212 Osage Avenue and the bowl of cereal, my cereal bowl, and the color television with the set, you know, with the antenna. So yeah, it's just like, I don't know if maybe that's why I also obsess over, well, I've explained, like, watch me obsessing over Soul Train isn't necessarily about me loving the show Soul Train, but more or less because every episode does a synesthesia thing with me that I know what happened this particular day. I mean, it'd be silly shit. Like, yeah, the most silliest one was, like, Shalimar's first appearance on the show.
Oh, I love that one.
Shalimar's first appearance on the show in 1977 triggers off a can of Pathmark No Frills Spaghetti Meatballs.
The good stuff.
Yeah. Stop dismissing me, Steve, in my dreams. I'm just
stop
saying that.
These dreams, Steve.
That's what I do.
It's, no, more. But it just takes me to a magical time in second grade at 7 years old. And I mean, it might be silly, but maybe that's how my memories are preserved.
That's totally how mine are.
Yeah, so it's almost like I'm happy with, you know, the Grammys and stuff, but maybe that's why they're in my bathroom. Like, like I don't dream of my own achievements more than I dream of preserving my memories.
But I don't think that's, I think he was talking about what would be your best your superpower. He was said to write a great song. I'm not sure that that's answering
the right, but that's the thing. Like, I never, well, my whole point was that I never had those dreams for myself, more or less discovering other people's great songs.
Right, and like putting being a tastemaker and putting people onto things. I feel like that's your other great thing. Because we have tastemakers on this show all the time, and that to me is always interesting, is watching you talk to those people, because they can define the culture and define music and define the things.
I don't even know if I'm going to put... See, that's why Bill is here. Like, Bill is my put people on...
Right, but you're kind of...
I'm like 10 years expired, though.
Or that. He's old, is the point.
Well, yeah, but... So but for you to be to be a teacher at such a young age, like,
I just really liked, you know, I was a kid. I grew up in the Bronx in the 1980s. My dad was a community organizer, and my mom stayed home with us, and then she did arts and education. So I was like a middle class outer borough kid. I went to this gifted program that was a borough wide gifted program, in the Bronx in the 80s, which is a fascinating group of people.
Can you explain because like a lot of us, and by a lot of us, I mean me, like I'm still thinking of come out and play.
Yeah, right. Like,
right. So
that's,
you
know, pretty much how it
explain,
was, right?
Basically.
You look like one of those.
Explain the Bronx and its difference. Because even now, like when I went to see Michael McDonald in the Bronx, like I was like, wait a minute.
People...
What the hell?
You know, the thing about the first of all,
it just sounds tough. It has
New York,
an X in
New
it.
York City, New York City is enormous. Each borough is enormous. Yeah. You're talking about 1.5 million people, somewhere thereabouts. Now, the Bronx in the 1980s was in a bad way. I mean, my dad's community organizing was basically focused on neighborhoods that were bordering the neighborhoods that were literally burning, from like the Bronx is burning, right? So arson, disinvestment, huge spike in both in crime, in drug addiction, all those things. He was doing community organizing in these neighborhoods that were sort of adjacent to those, trying to kind of hold the line against this scourge of disinvestment and flight that had taken place in the borough. You know, the world that I lived in was a really interesting world in grade school that I'm forever grateful to, because it was very multiracial. I mean, the borough is probably, you know, 25% white. Maybe
I never knew.
Yeah, it's probably like 70 or 80% black and brown. And so the program, the school I went to, which was a borough-wide program, you know, you just got really used to being one of only a few white people in spaces all the time, in school, in classes, in dances, and all in competitions and all that stuff. And I think it was a really good formative experience. And, you know, for all of the Bronx is burning, Warriors, all that, you know, it's a huge borough with a huge working middle class. And these were people whose parents, you know, owned a bodega, drove city buses, worked as bank tellers, you know, had working class, middle class jobs. And, you know, it was not a place with a lot of privilege, but it was a fascinating and culturally explosive universe. I mean, we were exposed. I was exposed to...
What year were you born? I'm sorry.
I was born in 1979.
So after the hip hop explosion of...
Yeah, so it wasn't like the you know,
right,
DJ Kool Herc, like
right,
apartment party sort of formative years, but I do remember my friend Kamal telling me that his cousin was in a special ed music video and then showing me the dance.
Okay.
Very good. I have a very live memory of that.
Right.
But so yeah, and I think that it just was a very, what was interesting about my upbringing in the Bronx particularly was, because of my parents and their education level, and then we moved to this neighborhood that was more affluent than the one that I grew up in, and then I went to a magnet high school in New York City. That's where a bunch of people went, including Lin-Manuel Miranda, Immortal Technique, a whole bunch of different folks, Bobby Lopez, who's, you know, got an EGOT and wrote Avenue Q and Frozen, and with his wife, and all these really interesting, talented people. But because of that, I had a very interesting upbringing in which I was exposed to like the full spectrum of American class status. So everything from kids in my class who were in and out of homelessness, food stamps, or in housing projects, through people who had 15-room apartments on Park Avenue. from ages, you know, from the time I was born to the time I went away to college, I had social interactions and saw patches of life in each of those different worlds, and that was really a huge part of, I think, my formative experience.
I don't condone bullying, but still the thought of Immortal Technique being the school bully to you and Lin-Manuel was one of the most hilarious.
As funny at the time, but yes, in retrospect.
I think when I first met you and didn't know that you knew Lin when you were interviewing us about Hamilton, you two told me, like, yeah, he used to throw us in the trash can, which I was like...
One of his best stories. He loves that story.
I'm sorry. Okay. For hip-hop verses, like, what verse would you have to study in high school?
The thing, they were always making people sing Bucktown. That was the thing. It was always sing Bucktown. It was like putting people in trash cans and making them sing Bucktown. Wow.
I'm sorry.
I don't know why.
That's one hip hop crime. I'll give a pass to. I'm sorry, because I want to do that to kids now. Sing Bucktown, damn it! Oh God. So leading to A Colony in a Nation. Why did you feel it was necessary to? Do you see this as sort of a supplement to Ta-Nehisi Coates' Me Against the
Between the World and Me.
I'm thinking of Tupac. Against the World.
Yeah, exactly.
Between the World and Me.
Same thing.
He knows what he meant.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I hope it's a kind of gateway to a whole mass of literature from, you know, Racecraft by Barbara and Karen Fields, Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi, to The New Jim Crow by Michelle Crow, by Michelle Alexander. There's a great book by James Foreman Jr. that actually won the Pulitzer this year. It came out right around the same time as A Colony in a Nation, called Locking Up Our Own, which is about the politics, crime, and punishment in predominantly black neighborhoods and cities, which is a really fascinating book, great book. The reason I wrote the book was I've always been really interested in criminal justice. I think the experience of growing up in New York City in the 80s and 90s during the peak of the kind of crime boom, I mean, 1993 or 1990.
Crack years.
Yeah. When I was 13, I started commuting down to Manhattan. You know, New York City's got 2,400 murders a year. It's got about 350 last year. So, and that's true. All index crimes basically were the same, right? All index crimes basically reduced by 80% from the peak in 92, 93 when I was a 13-year-old walking around getting my starter caps jacked like every other day.
Whoa.
First you bend the cap.
Wait, what?
Bend the cap.
Yeah, oh, yes.
No, first slam the cap.
Wait a minute. Is that Jeff joke?
Yeah, went to starter cap. That's where my brain went.
Okay.
So I wanted to write about it, and I wanted to write about, I was covering Ferguson, I was covering Baltimore, Freddie Gray, I was covering some of the stuff that went down in Chicago even before Laquan McDonald and Eric Garner here in New York, and wanted to kind of write about it, and was kind of worried about, I think I had a moment of, is this a topic that a white man should write a book about? And I think I came to believe that actually part of the problem with the way I think particularly white people think about the system, even if they're sympathetic to the aims of, say, Black Lives Matter, is that it's essentially like some other ancillary problem. Like, that's a thing that is a problem.
It's not my problem.
Like, it's a bad thing, and it's a bummer that happens. But
I feel bad.
I'm not implicated in it. It's like part of the point of the book is like, no, you very much are. We collectively as a democratic society, but particularly as white majorities and particularly as white voters, have created this system that puts more people in prison than anywhere else in the world in a per capita basis. It didn't just come about. It wasn't handed down by, you know, Moses, and it wasn't the product of backroom lobbyists. It was actually voters going to the polls and voting for people that ran really racist ads about getting tough on crime and crack, you know, crack thugs and things like that. And so part of the project of the book is to say, look, you're implicated in the system. We all are as democratic citizens. And the system that we built fails to live up to the democratic aspirations and promises we have. And so we should all be troubled by that, and we should all be trying to unbuild that system. And that's sort of the idea behind why I wanted to write the book.
Oh, well, as far as the target audience to whom it should hit, how do you propose, not even reading your book per se, but it's like, how do you even plant the seed in people's minds, especially the times that we live in now, where journalists aren't trusted that much, the idea of fake news and liberal media is just, oh, you're just a liberal, and you know, which is like instant turn off. So it's like, how do you, is it like, okay, let me just save the people that are on the fence now? And
I think, you know, it's a good question. The hope always, I think, when you're writing is that you can speak to people, whoever they are, if they're willing to give you a charitable read. The book, it's funny, watching now this sort of national conversation that started to click in a deer. Do you see the thing about T.I. today?
No.
You see this? I was on the way over here. T.I. got arrested because someone called the cops on him as he was trying to get into his own gated community in Atlanta.
Yeah, no, that's it's real, because sometimes you don't have your code. And
and someone was like, who's this dude?
Right, yeah.
And I think as we're having this national conversation about, you know, there's a Starbucks incident, there's been a bunch of this, and I think it's been really, really...
Wait, he got arrested?
There was an AP bulletin as I was coming up here saying that T.I. got arrested
for breaking into his own house.
Breaking into his own house.
Damn, even the cops come up like, oh, you're T.I.
Yeah. Well,
that's horrible.
Clearly they didn't.
Yeah. That didn't go as well as I thought it would. Yeah.
So, you know, the book, A Colony and Nation, like, it starts and ends on a question of when to call the cops. Like, the first sentence of the book is, when's the last time you called the cops? And the last sentence of the book is recounting a story of me being in Prospect Park and taking out my phone and considering whether I should dial 911. And the reason that I started and ended with that is because that is a thing that, you know, Ferguson or the police shooting people might seem abstract to a citizen. Mm-hmm. Like, well, I'm not a cop, but people call the cops a lot. You're part of the link in the chain, and I think it's really important we're having this discussion right now. I think primarily white people, and I think people that, you know, don't want to end up screwing people over, about like, when should you call the cops?
Right.
Should you call the cops because someone has been at a Starbucks for 2 minutes, or that people are going too slowly on the golf course? Like, I don't think so. I think you should not call the cops. I think you should not call the cops unless someone's life is in danger, basically.
Well,
you know, if there is violence imminent or that you witnessed, if there is a danger that you're witnessing, you should call 911. Short of that,
I think a lot of the times the cops are used because people are generally just afraid of confrontation.
Conflict. They don't want to say, of course. It's so much easier. I mean, and that's
do my fighting for me. Like,
yeah, and the first example I gave in the book is calling, the last time I did call the cops was when watching a guy basically intimidate, sort of threaten his girlfriend on the street and screaming at her.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I didn't want to go out there and be like,
hey, you,
what are you doing?
Get your hands off of her.
I was like, I'm going to make
George, no.
I was like, no, I'm going to make a phone call.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app
trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
There's also a... There's a part of the book in which he explained that, which I'm actually shocked at, the fact that you were explaining about you coming home from a school dance and you got accosted by some undesirables.
We call them thugs.
Yeah.
We call them thugs. And somehow I was like, wow, like that would have instantly... changed my mind, because even in my head to this day, when I visit my childhood home, I'm still looking for Big Reggie and his cousin Lamar.
Like, yep, yep.
Like, I'm certain, and I hate to say this, I'm certain they're dead by now, which I shouldn't say this, but
no, it's still there.
Even in getting out of my car, like as a near 50-year-old, my first thing I thought about was, Big Reggie Lamar might be down the block.
Big Reggie Lamar.
Hey, man, taking someone's Pac-Man money is some big shit back in the early 80s. So, yeah, and I, you know, like that one incident at the arcade in my childhood has almost scarred me for life.
Yeah.
Where I'm always looking, you know, I'm shell-shocked. And the fact that that happened to you, and I thought, like, wow, at no point were you just like, Dad, why the hell are we up here? And I should be living this life of, you know, and I don't know if the P word is a 4-letter word to white people to say like privileged or anything, but like, we don't have to live here, Dad. Like, what, why did you not ever, actually, what made you, come to this point of understanding where most people don't do that?
I think that, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, we were scared all the time. And we got, and part of that was, I think that was true of every teenager in New York City at that age. Like, you just, that happened. You got jacked. Like, run your loot, run your bus pass, jacket, backpack, starter cap, whatever. I think part of it was, at the same time that was happening, the ethos at my high school and at my middle school and even in grade school, although more when you're an adolescent, you're thinking about, like, what's cool. Everything that was cool was urban. Everything that was cool was emanated from communities of color. Like the center of gravity of everything culturally, of the worldview, of what we wanted to be, of the music we listened to, everything was non-white.
Right.
So I think there's ways that that can get real pathological and kind of fetishistic, you know, in certain ways. But our experience of it, I think, was just that yeah, that was just part of being in the city, but the city was great and we were urban kids and that's what mattered. And that was the kind of cultural world we inhabited.
So to you, that was just a part of growing up in New York.
Yeah. I mean, it stressed me out a lot. It I spent a lot of time scared. I really did. I walked around the city all the time. You know, my brother tells this hilarious story because when I was telling him about the book, he was talking about how, you know, everyone wore JanSports. And the style was that you wore them like hitting against your butt, like they were all the way low on you. Like the loop was as big as possible. But that if something was about to go down, you would like preparatorily grab the straps,
tighten it up,
and pull them up to tighten because you were gonna have to book it and you didn't want it like
wait, Bill,
Bill is laughing Bill's in recognition.
Bill did that in Indiana like, for sure.
I'm having flashbacks right now. Yeah,
there you go. Like,
yeah. But Bill, you're like 7 feet tall.
Didn't matter.
Just the moment right before shit was gonna go down was always like strap them up, like yeah. Like pull the straps on the JanSport so you could book.
So you can book. Okay. So thanks, Steve.
What? I thought
people
it's
not
a funny
say book?
It's no. An old school term. Is that
an old school term?
Yes, I get it.
It's like when I call my wife boo, and the millennials in my office are like, what are you saying?
book is much older than
yeah,
boo.
That's true,
yeah,
that's true.
You explained how, you know, because you're saying that at one point crime was at an all-time high.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it stopped. And now as a new New Yorker, I always wondered about that because when I first arrived in New York City.
When did you move here?
Well, okay. I'd moved here in 2009, which, I mean, gentrification had already taken over. Yeah. But I'm talking about when we as a group first started to record up here. I mean, we would stay here, but
right.
I mean, I guess technically maybe I have lived here for 25 years and just haven't admitted it. Yeah. But the thing was, is that when we first moved, ironically, on 46th Street, where Hamilton is right now, everyone kept complaining about like the Disneyfied occasion of Times Square, of which I didn't know any better. Like, I didn't get that they were longing for I didn't even know that was there. And I was like, wait, this is great. Like, it's like a mall. And there's Roy Rogers Chicken across the street. And there's a McDonald's over there. And there's a movie theater. Like, this is really awesome. And people were like, everyone complained about that happening. And then even more recently, and looking for homeless people, I discovered that they've all been moved out of Manhattan. So
why were you looking for homeless people?
We did a photo shoot in which they ordered way too much food and the interns were about to throw like 20 boxes of pizza away. Perfectly good. And I was like, nah, let's give them to the homeless. But then it was like a 2-hour search for
that's fascinating.
Yeah, like I found people in Brooklyn near a shelter, but at 42nd Street, when I was going through the bus station, the cop was like, Questlove? And I was like, I didn't do it. But and I hit him. I was like, yo, I said, I thought I'd come here with, you know, the bus station, but where are the people at? And they kind of laughed at each other like a joke, like, isn't that cute? He said, nah, man, you ain't going to find them down here. And I was like, what happened to them? And he kind of leveled with me. He was a black dude, so he just leveled with me, like, yeah, dog, they don't allow homeless no more. Like, they up in, like, past the Bronx, like, in Yonkers. And I was just like, oh. So it wasn't, because when people say those stats, like, you know, crime is going down and homelessness and da-da-da-da-da, you're made to think, like, suddenly, like, you know, there are more jobs and people and less crime because people are more moral. But no, like, either people have been killed or thrown in jail or just put on a bus. Displaced and put, yeah, that he explained about the one-way ticket system that I never knew about. There was a period in, I think, 2001 where if they put you on a plane or a bus, then someone's on the other side to get you. That's how they got rid of you, which isn't necessarily fixing the situation either.
Yeah, there's two things about, I think, the way the city changed. One is that it really did get less dangerous. But then there's this ambient thing I talk about in the book of just like seediness. And that was such a part of what the experience of New York was, which was a little related to the threat of danger, but also just this kind of ambient thing of there were squeegee men who would come and there were a lot of panhandlers and there were people all the time who were kind of like quasi living in subway stations. And it had this feeling. You see a lot of discourse about this around San Francisco right now. They're constantly writing about that. Like, oh, there's all these drug addicts, there's all these homeless. Mm-hmm. And New York City was very much had that feeling to it. And it was a real thing. And this sense of like cleaning it up, which is very loaded politically in terms of what it means and for whom, particularly in Manhattan, right? I mean, particularly It's like, well, we're going to clean up Midtown. We're going to clean up downtown, clean up the financial district, clean up Bryant Park. That was all this very much a kind of business oriented thing, much more than, you know, communities coming together because they wanted it for their neighborhood. But one of the complicated things about this, right, is that folks who live in neighborhoods don't love a bunch of people hanging out outside a liquor store either. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, like, it's not always just this external thing of, you know, the business district or this power structure from outside. There's always, and this is one of the things that James Vollmer Jr. talks about in his book, Locking Up Our Own, is like the internal dynamics of neighborhoods about who's, you know.
I'm sorry, side note, I kind of missed the neighborhood wino. I haven't seen a good wino in about 20 years. Like,
you've been searching the wrong place, apparently.
Nah, man, I just missed the neighborhood wino. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
So there was a real transformation that happened in the city and the experience of it. And that experience was a very intentional thing that was done by Giuliani and then Bloomberg, broken windows I write about in the book, like this whole thing about how there's a whole theory that there's a relationship between those two things, that if people are jumping turnstiles, it sends a message to everyone else that lawlessness is okay, and then you get lots of murder. And that was the argument. And a lot of people, it wasn't a bad faith argument. I think people really believe that argument. But what ended up happening is the city starts enforcing these low-level misdemeanor things, selling M&Ms on the subway, jumping turnstiles, yada, yada, yada.
You can't sell M&Ms on the subway no more?
People
those little kids?
People get citations for selling M&Ms on the subway every day in New York City.
Putting their feet up on a seat.
Or putting their feet up or doing the Showtime thing.
Oh, yeah. Showtime.
No more performances?
Move up. Move up. No.
Steve prevents me from getting on the subway, so I would have actually seen this. I suggested that he and I take the subway down there, and Steve has this thing in his mind where he has to be my protector.
It's not the most pleasant place to be, you know, as a celebrity.
Right.
If that's,
I've ridden the subway with him, and like nobody.
I had a hoodie on. I rode a celebrity with a tuxedo on with the rest of the roots, and no one bothered us.
Really?
It was like Obama was in town.
Did you see that Instagram? There was Instagram of when the Cavs were in town. Do you see that? It was pretty funny.
Where they were on the subway.
They were on the subway. Yeah. Like, it was like the whole Cavs squad taking the subway to Madison Square Garden when they were in town to play the Knicks. And I forget what happened, but LeBron is definitely on there. He's got a hoodie on. And I think no one recognized him. I'm pretty sure no one recognized him.
I can't remember.
But it's a really funny. Like, there's a woman next to LeBron, I think, who's kind of like making a face because they're like acting the fool a little bit.
Right.
And she doesn't like them acting up, but has no idea that she's next to like literally one of the most famous people on earth.
Right. See, let's take it some way.
No, that's a squad of 8-foot black guys, and instead of me and you on the subway. It's a different thing.
Big Steve and little Amir.
Little Amir, I need protection. So, where do you see? Do you see an end to this nightmare?
Why is everybody laughing?
If the nightmare ends, then we won't watch the news. I'm not saying you yourself are like,
thanks, thanks a lot, man.
Well, didn't Les Moonves say like the
bad for the country, good for us? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the answer. I don't know how it ends. I really don't. I think everyone.
So you don't have a vision in your head of like, okay, so, you know, you got to check your phone every 12 seconds to see if.
No, that I Michael do. That I do. Just, Michael Cohen got indicted. No, he didn't. I'm saying checking my phone to see if he did.
Oh, yo, dude. I'm like, really? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Actually, Manny Patinkin's coming back in to tell us.
He'll sing it.
But do you but do you have like, this
my
vision?
Name is Amigo Montoya. Sorry, go ahead. I'm going to do all my Manny Patinkin shtick and row. Go.
Do you have this vision of like all of them getting arrested in slow motion and,
You know?
I mean, look, I think everybody has their own kind of fantasies about how it all ends. And, you know, I think there's some...
I feel like it's going to happen, but I...
Here's my... My thing about this, which is a little school marmish, but I'll do it anyway, which is that I think people want some deliverance. They want a white knight. They want a Deus Ex Machina. They want some way to be rescued. They want the bad guys to get carted away. They want Bob Mueller to sort of ride in and slay the dragon. And my thing about this, which is the same theme of the book, is it's just us in a democracy. Like, it's just us. It's us as citizens. It's we. No one's going to do it for you. The work, like, that's just the way it works. It's the hard thing about democracies is they take a lot of exertion to make them work well. You can outsource all that shit. You can say, I trust these people in charge. They're just going to do it. And I'm going to show up to vote, or maybe even not vote, but at the minimum, just show up and vote and be like, okay. But
so even in the hands of Stormy's lawyer, Michael
Avenatti. I mean, he's a great character.
Do you roll your eyes at him? But do you not feel as though he has traction?
He's got traction, man. Do your thing, dude. I don't begrudge anyone anything. Everyone's doing all this stuff. I'm just saying, the ending will. I think the ending will be written by us collectively as a society, as opposed to some squad of Elliot Ness untouchables that bring down the ring. And even though I think that there's a possibility that Bob Mueller does like indict a lot of people, don't get me wrong.
Right.
I think people in the president's circle definitely committed crimes. That's already been established, but even worse than we know. I just think that in a deeper sense of will it be okay, the answer to that question lies with us as opposed to someone else.
Do you believe that Mueller is, all right, to compare this to like a police drama, instead of arresting the corner boy, instead of arresting the corner boy and his drug dealer boss, that Mueller is actually trying to cast a wide net amongst anyone involved? Like, this is a bigger story.
Even bigger than
Trump being president.
I think he has gone, all indications from the outside is that he has gone about this in both a methodical way and in the kind of way that you would attempt to go after or roll up an organized crime ring. Yeah. And I think that's been pretty clear. I mean, the craziest stories to me are the international stories where, you know, some oligarch shows up on a private jet in Kennedy and gets off the plane and it's like, excuse me, sir, the FBI come with us, and like search his phones, question him, that whole thing. And that's happened multiple times to multiple people. Mm-hmm. They've got agents working overseas. So, there's a lot going on in that. I don't know what ultimately that will bear out, but I do have a fair amount of faith in the diligence with which they're approaching that job. I just don't know.
Okay, so in your version, this is my last question, in your version of All the President's Men, who's playing you in the movie? And I'm slowly...
Nice.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I like
who's
that.
Who's playing you?
Mandy Patinkin.
Mandy Patinkin.
There you go, Mandy Patinkin. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Chris Hayes, for enlightening
us.
Hopefully you're not too traumatized right now. On behalf of Boss Bill, Unpaid Bill, and Sugar Steve, this is Questlove Supreme, only on Pandora. We will see you on the next go-round.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Lisa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit lisa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.